tonight on Arena. Waterboys Mike Scott on the album Life, Death and Dennis Hopper. And Four Mothers are among the films for review. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RT Arena or watch live on rte.ie/arena. Few artists have followed a creative path as eclectic and adventurous as Mike Scott. As the driving force behind the Waterboys for more than four decades, Scott has moved between grand stadium-sized rock, intimate folk and experimental spoken word. His latest project, Life, Death and Dennis Hopper, continues that journey, using the life of the American actor and director as a lens through which to explore reinvention and the price of creative obsession. On this new album, Scott has assembled an impressive cast of collaborators, including Steve Earle, Fiona Apple and Bruce Springsteen. Each helps Scott to paint a vivid portrait of Hopper's tumultuous life. I'm delighted to be joined in studio by Mike Scott to tell us more about the life, death and death of Dennis Hopper. But let's have a listen to Dennis Hopper in his most countercultural, in his groundbreaking role as Billy and his directorial debut in the 1969 cult classic Easy Rider.
No, man, like, hey, man, wow, I was watching this object, man, like the satellite that we saw the other night, right? And, like, it was just going right across the sky, man, and then, I mean, it just suddenly, it just changed direction and went whizzing right off, man. It flashed.
You're stoned out of your mind, man.
Oh, yeah, man, hey, like, I'm stoned, you know, man? But, like, you know, I saw a satellite, man. And it was going across the sky, and it flashed three times at me and zigzagged and whizzed off, man. And I saw it.
The wonderful Dennis Hopper there from Easy Rider, his 1969 directorial debut as well, Mike.
That's right.
So this is a deep dive into the life of Dennis Hopper. Tell us, what was it that attracted you first? Was it his films?
Well, I knew him as an actor. I'd seen Easy Rider, and then I'd spotted him in Rebel Without a Cause and Apocalypse Now and a few other places. But I hadn't got any huge interest in him. I liked him, but it didn't go much further than that. And then one day I was in London and I was walking around in the West End and I passed a big art gallery and there was a poster in the window for something called The Lost Album by Dennis Hopper. And I couldn't compute, did the word album mean it was music? Dennis Hopper was an actor. This was an art gallery. What was it all about? So I walked in to find out, and I encountered hundreds of these beautiful black and white photographs that Dennis had apparently taken in the 60s. It turned out he was a fantastic photographer, and it was his photography that I first fell in love with.
Yes, because he was called the Tourist, wasn't he?
His friends called him the Tourist because he always has ever-present Nikon around his neck, yes.
Now, he was born in Kansas, and Kansas is the first track on the album. Can you talk us into this? It's not your voice on vocals.
No. Well, I had written this lyric about Dennis's boyhood called Kansas, and I'd set it to music, but the music didn't have the right American feel, and I thought, gosh, who could write a wonderful piece of Americana music to go with this? And I thought, my old friend Steve Earle, maybe. And Steve did. He loved the lyric and he put it to a beautiful piece of music. And the idea originally was that I would sing it. I would go and record it with the Waterboys. But Steve did it so well, I realised there's no way I'm going to sing this. It's got to be Steve Earle. And so it's him starting the album.
Yes, and it is about Dennis Hopper living in Kansas, feeling maybe cut off from his future, cut off from the possibilities.
Yeah, he's wanting to leave Kansas. You know, one of these people, like so many of us, who wants to escape the milieu that he grew up in and discover the unknown.
Don't say I didn't tell you so. Will I remember you, Kansas? Hell, I don't even know. I don't even know.
That's Kansas there from Life, Death and Dennis Hopper, the Waterboys' new album. And Mike Scott is here with me. You're just saying Mickey Raphael is on harmonica there.
Yeah, from Willie Nelson's band.
Wow, yeah. Wow. You've got all the, you've collected all these stars.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course you've worked with them or you know them.
I know some of them a little bit, yeah. I knew Steve. Bruce Springsteen, who does a voiceover on the record. I've met him once. He came to a Waterboy show here in Dublin. It was at the Ivy Gardens. And fortunately for me, I didn't know he was in the audience. And it would have to be the one night that I played a guitar solo lying on my back. And then I found out later Bruce was there. But he came backstage at the end. He was very, very gentlemanly.
And you were always a fan of his as
a
boy, weren't
indeed.
You?
Well, as a teenager, I discovered him in the mid to late 70s. Yeah.
All right. Will we play that bit of Bruce? So
oh, just, yes.
So just explain, it's 10 years, 10 years gone.
Yeah.
So I felt this was kind of a dream world of where is Dennis now?
Well, this was Dennis's lost decade from roughly 1973 to 83 when he was drunk and he was doing all kinds of stuff he shouldn't have done and really very, very self-destructive. And it went on for a long time before he pulled himself together. And so 10 years gone is about those years. And the music is, to me, it sounds real claustrophobic. I'm trying to create in the music the sense of the pressure that he must have felt and the weird space that he must have been in.
And then towards the end of the track, Bruce Springsteen comes in.
Yeah, if you play the track, everyone will know when Bruce comes in. He's very recognisable.
Well, we've done something sneaky. We're just playing the Bruce bit because we've loads of you coming up.
Okay.
10 years ago.
So Dennis Hopper's last weekend was 10 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So to speak.
Yes. Yeah. So when he left Kansas and came to Hollywood, he was a pretty instant success, like working with James Dean and then becoming a director himself.
Oh, he didn't become a director for many years. It was about 14 years between the two things. He was a contracted actor. And his first job in Hollywood was being one of the juvenile delinquents in Rebel Without a Cause.
Yes, and then he went on. He had a role in the next in Giant. Sorry, I was
in
trying
Giant,
to.
Yes, yes, also yeah, with James yeah, Dean. Yeah, with and James Dean was a kind of a big brother figure to Dennis, a mentor figure.
Yes, because I think he knew he was a great actor, Dennis Hopper, until he met James Dean.
That's what he thought. Yeah.
Yes, and then he learned from James Dean. It's really lovely. And is it around that time then that he started collecting art as well as being the tourist taking photographs?
Yeah, I think so. Yes, he lived in Los Angeles in the early 60s. With his wife Brooke, and they would collect art and they decorated their house with all the art and turned it into this sort of pop art wonderland. It was a famous house at the time.
Yes, yeah, because there's photographs of him as a Roy Lichtenstein. He has a photograph of him. Yeah, it's really fantastic. Well, Andy Warhol was among that group and he has a number of Warhol paintings. And you have a track on the album called Andy, A Guy Like You.
Yeah. Well, you see, Andy was unknown when he first met Dennis, and Dennis championed him. And the legend, I'm not sure if it's true, but the legend is that Dennis was one of the first people to buy one of those Campbell's soup can paintings. But what is true is that Dennis hosted Andy in Los Angeles and introduced him to everyone in the Los Angeles art scene and helped Andy break through.
Let's listen to this. Andy, A Guy Like You. Andy, A Guy Like You from Life, Death and Dennis Hopper. And that's Mike Scott and the Waterboys, obviously. Mike, the difference in style between that and Kansas. You must have had great fun, did you, playing with the different musical styles you could put into his life?
Yes, I did. I didn't set out to make an album with all these different styles. It's just the way it came. You know, writing songs about a period in time probably affected the way that I approached the music, but I didn't preconceive it.
Right, yeah, because that could be out of some 1960s TV show.
Yeah, well, it's set in 1963.
Yeah. Then you talk about there was 14 years before he started directing, and then to do something like so iconic as Easy Rider. Mm. How did he, like, was he part of the counterculture when he went to do Easy Rider, or was it kind of all around the same time? He was always open to new experiences, wasn't he?
Well, he'd grown up like all of that generation from first the first big bang of rock and roll and youth culture around 1955, and then through all the changes of the 60s, and he'd gone through psychedelia and civil rights and the hippie scene. So he had lived all that before he made Easy Rider. So it's an authentic portrayal. And the thing about Easy Rider was it was the first time that anyone making a movie had authentically captured that alternative lifestyle. Yeah, that little clip you played of him, that's really what guys sounded like at that time. You know, before that, when people tried to present youth culture or hippie or counterculture in films, it was all sort of reefer madness and all this sort of square stuff that missed the point. But Dennis nailed it in Easy Rider, and that's why it was such a success.
Then after Easy Rider, he went to do this project called The Last Movie.
Mm, indeed.
And was this the thing that nearly broke him, really? Or,
well, you see, because he had success with Easy Rider, it was a worldwide hit. The studios gave him carte blanche to do whatever he wanted next. And Dennis was very happy with that because he wanted control. He liked to do things his own way. So he flew everyone down to Peru to film The Last Movie, which was set up in the Andes. These mountains. And I think because he had complete freedom, and also because he was kind of out of it, and he was hoist by his own petard, thinking that everything he did was going to be great, whether he thought about it correctly or not. You know, he was a bit careless. And he blew it. And he did, it turned in a very bad edit of what could have been a great film.
Yes, because I was saying to you, I had seen it, and I didn't know we had seen it when I worked in the Irish Film Institute. And we played it. We wondered afterwards, had we played the film in the right order, you know, because they came in kind of film cans.
Yes. Now, I'm sure you did. It's just weirdly edited.
Then there were the women, and you give women central place in the album.
Well, he had five wives. He was married five times. We've done an instrumental for each wife.
So there's Brooke Hayward, who was very much like Hollywood royalty.
She was the daughter of a big-time Hollywood agent and an actress, yes.
Yes, and then there was the very short, but obviously pretty iconic marriage to Michelle Phillips.
Mm, this is Michelle from the Mamas and Papas. They were married for 8 days, and Dennis famously said, well, the first seven were pretty good.
And things went downhill on the last day. Yeah. We have, you have such a wonderful team of collaborators on this, as well as your wonderful water boys, obviously. And in this one, you have Fiona Apple. This is Letter from an Unknown Girlfriend.
Yes, not about one of the five wives. It's, as the title says, it's an unknown girlfriend.
Okay, can you talk us into it?
Well, there are a few recorded incidents of Dennis punching a lady. And I thought, well, all right, I'm going to cover this in the album too, where it's warts and all. So I wrote this song, Letter from an Unknown Girlfriend, written as if, let's say for the sake of argument, that perhaps Dennis had dated a singer-songwriter. I don't think it ever happened, really. But if it had, she might have responded in a song on one of her albums. So that's the song we set out to make. And I wanted a female voice singing it. And Fiona Apple had done a wonderful cover of The Hole of the Moon about 5 or 6 years ago. She brought a real emotional edge to it as well. And I thought, oh, she's the person to sing this song. And she certainly did. She delivered.
Letter from an Unknown Girlfriend there, featuring Fiona Apple. And of course, The Water Boys is the album is Life and Death and Dennis Hopper. And it's from The Water Boys. And Mike Scott is here with me. Mike, to accompany the album, there's a film called A Wild and Beautiful Ride. And in the film, you really present the songs, and you talk about your interest in Hopper, and then you again give us different styles in the way you present the songs.
How do you mean? Sorry, I thought, don't understand.
Well, you know, let's say there, I can't remember which track now, but it's kind of 1960s Day Glow. And
that's probably Hoppers on Top.
Yes, yeah. Hoppers on Top, yeah. Yes, yeah. Yeah. And then there's wonderful scenes in it, for example, when you go to Dennis Hopper's grave.
Yes, indeed. We went to Taos in New Mexico, where Dennis used to live and where he's buried. And where he also did that terrible edit of the last movie. And the place is very heavy with Dennis's atmosphere. He's still alive there, really. And we filmed in his old home and at the graveyard and at his old theatre, the El Cortez, where he used to show rough cuts of his movies. And the film is about 45 or 50 minutes long, and we're showing it at the IFI in Dublin tomorrow. Special screening, it's sold out. We're hoping to have it on a streaming service soon so that everybody can see it.
And going there to where he would have worked in LA and then going to where he would have shown his films and to where he's laid to rest. How did you feel about your whole project and your whole deep dive into his life?
Oh, it felt really good. I had wondered, while I was making the record, sometimes I would think, what would Dennis make of all this? Or, I mean, here I am, writing 20 songs about Dennis Hopper. What would he think? And I could only guess, really, and I don't want to get stuck in any of that. And I didn't know Dennis in life, you know, I never met him. Probably just as well, because I wouldn't have been able to write all these songs if I had met him, although, of course, I would love to have met him. But I felt right about it all the way through the project. It always felt like it was like an overlit project. It came very easily. It was almost like at times I would think maybe Dennis is sort of behind me, turning my handle to make me write all these songs. I could almost believe that.
And then you are an artist, he's an artist, very different kinds of artists. But did you see similarities in your life? Let's say projects, like big projects that you would undertake and how you would deal with working with other people and getting absorbed, like his bad edit in the last movie. Did you see similarities in your life?
Maybe in the intensity that he went into each project, but otherwise, no, not really. No, he's a very different character from me. And that's part of what I found attractive about him, I think.
And there, when we heard the letter from the unknown girlfriend, was there parts of his life that you found just dark and unlikable, or did you always try and understand him?
Well, I would always try and understand anyway, but there were certain things that were unlikable, But you know, I always came back to liking Dennis. And even when he was at his most hubristic or big-headed, I found him quite lovable.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And even later then, I've seen, I saw some YouTube videos of him giving lectures about acting. And this is, he's a little later in his life then. And he's so articulate and brilliant and won't take a small performance or won't, you know, is always striving for the best with his students and with himself.
Yes.
It makes sense of roles like Blue Velvet, which were so, I suppose, you know, uncomfortable because he pushed himself that far.
Yes, he inhabited them very deeply, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And like in the film, I hope you don't mind me, I hope this doesn't spoil it, you talk about meditation and you talk about in some way trying just for yourself to see, does Dennis feel, how would Dennis Hopper feel about this? In some way you were trying to connect with him.
Oh, actually, I didn't try to connect with him. No, I did a particular meditation where I was, I learned to meditate a very long time ago. So it's something that I do now and then these days. And it comes back to me as kind of second nature now. And I was in a particularly deep meditation and I was connecting with the sense of people from my own family who'd gone before me. I was connecting with ancestors. And I found myself in the meditation. I was kind of, it's a weird thing to describe because it's, you know, people who don't meditate maybe wouldn't understand this, but I found myself in two places simultaneously. Like I was in a room in my chair, sitting in the chair, you know, there were my feet in the ground and I was breathing. But I was also imaginally And yet there was an objective reality to it. I was in another place, and it was a kind of borderlands place. And when I felt into it and began to, my eyes closed, and began to sense into this place that I found myself in, I felt myself in the presence of people who'd passed over, family members who'd passed over, family members who had known, and then other people who had known who'd passed over. And as I explored this inner territory further, I came into contact with the spirit of Dennis, or at least what I perceived to be the spirit of Dennis. I can't say for sure. These things, you have to do it on trust, really. And the feeling I got, however, was that Dennis, or whatever was the entity that I encountered, was good with the album and knew all about it and was kind of slapping me on the back, and it was cool.
And how present was he to you?
Extremely present. But as I say, these things, meditations, you know, it's not like a physical reality where you're meeting someone in a room. And probably a lot of people who talk about this kind of stuff, I don't willingly talk about it, but you've asked me, so I will. But I think a lot of people talk about this stuff in a glamorous way and try and make it look like something. To me, it's a very personal issue. But I have the sense that I encountered something of Dennis's spirit, and all was good.
And all was good. Yeah. What a great impetus for you to keep going.
Yeah.
We're going to play another track now, I Don't Know How I Made It.
Oh, excellent.
So will you talk us into that?
Well, after Dennis got straight and came back and got his life together, he gave a lot of interviews. And in one of them, he was talking about how he almost died. And he said to the interviewer, "I don't know how I made it." And just at the time I was reading that interview, my band had sent me some instrumentals for me to put lyrics to. And that phrase, "I don't know how I made it," already so musical, so rhythmical, fitted one of the pieces of music. So I joined the two together and made a song out of it.
Okay, let's listen to it.
But I made it somewhere back along.
I don't know how I made it. And that was Taylor Goldsmith featured there on that track, Mike.
He's a falsetto voice. Yeah.
Yes, yes. The very distinctive voice is Mike Scott's voice, obviously. Your band members then, they sent you tracks. Did they know that you were working? They obviously knew you were working on this big Dennis
Hopper. No, they didn't. This was way back at the beginning. They sent me a zip folder full of instrumental tracks with a little note saying, "Can you put lyrics to these?"
Oh, right. So they were working away on their own.
Yeah.
And thought, let's get Mike, you know, up and at it.
Yeah, they did a recording session. It was in London. Our drummer at the time, Ralph, had a studio in London, and three of them got together there and recorded these beautiful instrumentals, man, and sent them to me. And I started putting lyrics to them, and they all turned out to be Dennis Hopper songs.
All right. And did they know? They didn't know you were doing the project.
No.
Okay.
No.
So when did they come on board then?
How do you mean?
You know, when did they? Did you send them back
yes, of course. I sent them back and probably explained, well, you know, you didn't know this was happening, but this is going to be an album about Dennis Hopper's life. Do you know who he was? And so on.
Oh, right. OK. Yeah. Now, the Waterboys have been through many evolutions over the year. Mm. What's the makeup of the Waterboys now?
The current band. We've got two keyboard players. There's brother Paul. He's from Memphis. James Halliwell, he's from Cornwall.
Yes, and you've kept him busy as well.
Yes, he's very busy with this record, co-writing. Yes, yeah. Yeah. And our bass player is from Dublin. He's Angus Ralston. He used to be in Picture House, a well-known Dublin band. And our drummer is from Belfast. He's called Eamon Ferris.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. And this, we're going to finish now with Hoppers on Top. This is the one I said was kind of psychedelic, day glowy.
Yeah.
Even the music
is pop art. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Hoppers on Top of your life.
Well, this song is written about the moment in 1969 when Easy Rider became a smash hit and the universe was bowing at Dennis's feet.
Okay, let's listen to Hoppers on Top.
Hurrah!
That is Hoppers on Top from Life, Death and Dennis Hopper. And that'll be released tomorrow on Sun Records. And there's also going to be a screening, as Mike said, of the documentary called A Wild and Beautiful Ride at the IFI in Dublin tomorrow evening. But I think you said it's sold out.
It is indeed.
Yeah. But they will get a chance, I'm sure, when it'll be screened, hopefully on some TV or...
And we're working on getting a streaming service showing it, yeah.
Excellent. And the Waterboys will be on the road around Ireland this summer, including the Three Arena on June the 7th. You're also in the Waterfront Hall in Belfast on the 8th of June, live at the Marquee in Cork on the 10th of July, Breakwater Festival Wexford on the 1st of August, and live at the Docklands in Limerick on the 17th of August. Full details from Mike Scott, waterboys.com. Mike Scott, thank you so much.
You are very welcome, Katie. Thank you.
Now to film reviews, and this week a novelist and his mam, a great Welsh actor and his dad, and the worst neighbour in the world. In Mr. Burton, the always lovable Toby Jones plays Philip Burton, the English teacher with a heart of gold who guides the early acting career of one Richard Walter Jenkins. No spoilers here, but you do know, don't you, who we're talking about. Restless tells the story of a single woman and a new empty nester whose terrible neighbours drive her mad. I'm joined in studio by Dee Malumby and Joe Griffin. And we're going to start tonight with the Irish film Four Mothers, which stars Fionnuala Flanagan as Alma and a Scottish actor James McArdle as her son Edward, a novelist who is caring for her after her stroke. She can only communicate through an iPad. Earlier this week, Dee, the co-writer of the film, Brothers Darren and Colin Thornton, were on Arena with me, and they said the film, in a nutshell, was about a mother and a son who both lost their voices in different ways, which I guess is one way of looking at it.
Yes, and I heard that interview actually, Kay. It was a very good one, so go back and listen to that. So it's an interesting one because what Darren and Colin Thornton were kind of talking about was, in writing the script for this, they were kind of drawing from their own experience. Because they too kind of were taking care of their infirm mother towards the end of their life. But the film is also kind of based on Mid-August Lunch, which is a film by Gianni Di Gregorio. So I was kind of curious about how exactly that would work, you know, the fact that it was, you know, an adaptation from an Italian film. But I have to say, this movie has Irishness stamped all over it. Like, one of the early scenes in this movie that I absolutely love is that Edward is meeting a couple of his friends who also have kind of ailing elderly mothers as well. And they all, the three of them, they're all gay, but they all meet at Mass of all places, because that's where their mammies kind of always go to kind of congregate and reconnect, I suppose. So there are lovely kind of little moments in that you really appreciate and can enjoy as an Irish viewer.
Yes, let's listen to a clip. The four mothers, they're on a bus with the central character, Edward, and they decide to give him advice.
You know, I was thinking that might be quite nice to go and see Andrew and the girls in London, wouldn't it? I mean, you know, you haven't seen them for ages. The girls are getting big. They'd love to see you. So I was thinking that I could take you over there and then you could stay with them for a few weeks.
It's too hard.
It's not too hard, Mom. Andrew can manage. Okay, and I'll show him exactly how you like everything done, and we can go through everything with him before we
get... Too much for him with the new baby. Why don't you come and stay too? We could have a nice holiday there.
Well, it's not really a holiday for me, is it?
Why?
Because what if I want to go and meet a nice man? Can't do that with all yous around, can I? Fucking destined to be single forever.
You can meet a nice man on your phone anytime.
Well, I can meet a nice man on my phone anytime.
Right. And where would I bring him? Here, well, I'd bring him here. What, to meet you? Okay.
Well, that's not going to work. You'd probably scare him away with your beady eyes.
Well, there was only one mammy in that clip, and that mammy was Alma. And she talks through the iPad, not as Fionnuala Flanagan sounds, but through an automated voice. And she was talking to Edward. And Edward is dying to get away for a break, because he also wants to go on a book tour, Joe, because he has, surprisingly for him, become an internet sensation with his new book in the States.
Yeah, so the story is kind of a push and pull between his professional responsibilities and his personal ones. And it's a very personal film for the filmmakers, as they've mentioned. I was at the preview screening with a Q&A last week, and they said that some scenes in the film were directly inspired by real life experiences, like having to conduct radio interviews or press meetings and stuff like that while simultaneously caring for their ailing mother. So, the character is kind of at a fork in the road where he's happy to look after his mother and hesitant to talk to her about it while he's getting these opportunities and professional pressure as he's being tugged away. And this leads to both comedy and farce. And the film is both a comedy and a farce.
And when the other mothers come in, because that's a bit of a challenge, isn't there? Because we've got Edward and Alma, Fionnuala Flanagan and James McArdle, who have got great chemistry between them. Mm-hmm. But then we're introduced to the three other mothers. How does that work out?
Yeah, and I have to say credit to all the actresses here because they're absolutely fantastic. The four mothers are played by Fionnuala Flanagan, Niamh Cusack, Dervla Molloy and Paddy Glynn. All four of them are absolutely fantastic. It's a great gang of characters. Initially, when the four mothers meet each other, they are just fed up of each other. They decide in this house, there's only room for one mother, and that's me. And each of them have kind of individually decided this as all of them kind of enter Edward and Alma's abode. Basically, what's happened is all of their sons have decided to dump them on Edward as the sons all head on a getaway to Mas Palomas Pride, which is this big international festival for kind of the LGBTQ community. So Edward is the one who's faced with kind of trying to, you know, meet all of their demands, you know, their various requests for breakfast. He's trying to coordinate doctor's visits, funerals, hair appointments, classes and more, all while trying to get his own work done, too. And this leads to like kind of a number of, you know, very comedic scenarios. There's great witty banter between all of the characters. They bounce off each other so well. So it's a very well written script in that both you have kind of the scenarios which are so absurd and funny in and of themselves, but also the script. There are just some great one-liners in this and a lot of laugh out loud moments, I have to say.
Okay, well, let's listen to the clip where the four mothers decide to help Edward's character by telling him what he should do with his life.
Edward, you can't cope.
I can't, ma'am, please stop, please.
I'm sorry to cause you trouble.
No, it's that you didn't mod it. It's fine, it's totally fine.
Who was your meeting supposed to be with?
My publicist. It's about promoting my book in America.
He is very important writer, but gets so nervous before his meetings.
Why do you get nervous?
I don't get nervous.
You should get Dermot to prescribe some anti-anxiety medication.
Dermot.
His therapist, my son.
I don't need anti-anxiety medication.
Well, so I take a half cheeky if I'm flying anywhere and there's not a bother on me then.
But I mean, I get that because if you don't like flying, but I don't need anti-anxiety medication. It's just I don't like having meetings, which is completely normal.
Why?
Because I don't like talking to people. I like being on my own.
Weird.
It's not weird, ma'am.
What was his father like?
Weird.
Ma'am!
You are just like your dad.
I am not. Do not compare me to dad right now, please.
The very same.
There, and it goes on and on with the four mammies wanting their way and yet giving him advice. For you, did it work, Joe?
Yeah, I thought it was really timely and funny and sweet. So if I were to give it a star rating, it'd be 4 stars for me.
4 from you and from you, Dee.
Yeah, 4 stars as well. I'm actually going to rewatch it with my mum and my grandmother this weekend and we're very much looking forward to it.
I hope you don't get into any trouble during that, man.
Maybe we'll see.
They question you. So next to Mr. Burton, which stars Toby Jones and Harry Lauty, who listeners will remember from his work on the BBC stockbroking drama Industry. Joe, the filmmakers are... Well, this is about Richard Burton's origin story, but he didn't start off as Richard Burton. And the man who did help him was Mr. Burton, his teacher.
Yeah, that's right. So when we meet the young Richard prior to taking on that surname. He's kind of a diamond in the rough. He's a working class kid in Port Albert, more interested in rugby and chasing girls than he is in drama. He doesn't seem like the great dramatist that we will one day see. Mr. Burton, the teacher, sees something in him. He sees his intelligence and his wit. And as punishment, one day he assigns him to memorize and recite a Shakespeare speech. And the boy ends up loving it and showing a knack for it. And then a kind of tentative friendship begins, and he becomes like more of a father figure to young Richard than Richard's actual father, a coal miner, was. So it's the journey from that callow, unpolished, undisciplined youth to the icon that we know today.
Yes, and indeed, this can be a challenge, I guess, particularly for the actor who is playing the Richard Jenkins character or the Richard Burton character.
Yeah, that's right. So Richard Jenkins, as he is initially known in the film, played by Harry Lawley, who's kind of this up-and-coming actor. People might recognise him. He was actually in the recent Joker, Folie à Deux. He played Harvey Dent in that play that was, a role that was so well known previously in The Dark Knight and everything. I thought he did a very good job at playing the young Richard. He is kind of, even though he has a very strong Welsh accent initially, and you're like, how the heck did this end up becoming, the Richard Burton that we know? He is very immediately handsome and charming, as we know Richard Burton was. And it's really exciting to see that under Mr. Burton's encouragement and, I suppose, tutelage, Richard Jenkins kind of gradually evolves into the Richard Burton who we know and love, or possibly even detest. And I thought it was interesting that even they have moments where the young man's choices can be quite an appealing. And as we know, Richard Burton was like maybe a flawed man in and of himself. And key to this really are the scenes between Mr. Burton and Richard Jenkins, whereby he is teaching young Richard to kind of speak more eloquently with a more distinctly English accent, kind of honing his acting skills, but more so kind of really emphasizing the voice, making sure that he enunciates, that he projects his voice. It reminded me a lot of Colin Firth and, Geoffrey Rush in The King's Speech, these kind of unconventional lessons. At one point he has Richard actually screaming into a field as
well. We have a clip of that, as you say, Toby Jones, as Mr. Burton has an unusual open air vocal exercise for young Richard Jenkins.
Let's hear it.
All for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention.
Stop! That is mostly dreadful. Right. Stand firm. Plant your feet. Shoulders back. Head erect. Good. Let's give it another try. Are you able to hear me?
Yes.
Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention. Are you able to hear that?
Yes.
Good. Now you have a try.
Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend...
Stop! Was I shouting?
No.
Volume, Jenkins, is of secondary importance. Distinctness. This is what you must learn. Now.
Toby Jones there as Mr. Burton, and Harry Lawley, the man who would become Mr. Richard Burton. Stars out of five from you, Dee.
It's an interesting true story and an enjoyable enough watch, but it is quite conventional. I'd probably describe it as a warm cup of tea of a movie, so it would be 3 stars for me.
3 stars. Mm-hmm. And from you, Joe.
Similar. I would give it 3 stars. Enjoyable enough, but a little underpowered for my taste.
OK, well, we'll be back with another film after the break. You're listening to Arena's Film Reviews with Dee Malumbi and Joe Griffin. So far, they've liked Four Mothers and they're a bit so-so about Mr. Burton. So, Dee, Restless is our final film and it's about a woman with a neighbour from hell. Tell us about Nikki.
Yes, so Nikki in the film is played by Lindsay Marshall. She's an empty nester who works as a nurse in a care home. What's interesting about this movie is that even before her neighbour from hell, as you describe him so aptly as, moves in, she's kind of already being pushed to the brink of burnout. The nursing home that she works in is understaffed. The employees are underpaid. Her boss is pressuring her to pick up more shifts. She's also quite isolated. She's lonely. She's single and her parents have recently passed. Her son has left for university, and while her sister does call her to check in, she does live far away. So she's kind of in the circumstance where she is really on her own a bit. But at the same time, you know, she lives this quiet, very peaceful life, and that is until Dino, played by Aston McCauley, moves in next door and decides that he's going to be throwing raucous parties all night, every night, and all Nikki wants is a good night's sleep.
And does the tension ratchet up pretty quickly, Joe?
Yeah, so it's kind of like water torture. The first few drops are okay, and then after a while, not so okay. So the very first night, actually, he moves in. He's up all night partying and the walls are thin and everything. And she's quite sanguine and philosophical about it, thinking he's excited to have moved in. And I'm sure it's just the first night. And then it gets worse and worse and repetitive, and then she confronts him about it and he becomes passive aggressive and then aggressive, and the stakes start to go up bit by bit, and it escalates.
Okay, does it work? And stars out of five from you, Joe?
Sorry, 3.5. I thought it was quite fun.
Okay, and from you, Dee?
Yeah, I'd say 3 out of 5 as well. It does build on that tension very nicely, and it was a satisfying conclusion. A bit unfocused as to whether it's a drama or black comedy, but generally really enjoyable.
Okay, 3 and 3.5. That's for Restless. And my thanks to Dee Malumbi and Joe Griffin. Restless, Four Mothers, and Mr. Burton will go on general release in cinemas tomorrow. That's it for tonight's show. The show was researched by Paula Shields and Liam Murphy. Mark McGraw was on sound. Mary Elizabeth Burton was the broadcast coordinator, and the show was produced by Reg Luby. John Creedon is next after the news.